Hi, everybody. It's David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 40, Sensitivity and Trying to Please Everyone. Now, hopefully you noticed that I didn't do an episode last week. Sorry to disappoint you if I did. We had family in town. I painted the house prior to them coming to visit, did a lot of other stuff. So I gave myself a mini vacation. I did a token amount of writing each day while people were visiting. And I did some publishing stuff here and there when I could squeeze in the time. But mostly I just didn't work too hard and just tried to enjoy the visit. And they went home today, which is why I am recording this afternoon on Thursday when, you know, Wednesday has mostly been my day in the previous months. But anyway, it was a good time off. I didn't feel too guilty about not doing a whole lot of writing. I did feel a little bit of guilt, but I did, like I said, a token amount each day to keep things moving, and that helps me a little. Overall, getting back into my writing tomorrow. I didn't do very much today. Tomorrow will be a normal day. But I'll be on pretty much the same projects that I've been talking about. The Pleasure Project, the Dane Maddock book, and the Super Secret Project are the three things that are mostly taking my attention right now, as well as business-related things. Did have a little bit of good news in the professional arena that I can actually... There goes my chair again, sorry, that I can actually talk about. I sold rights to one of my books to a Bulgarian publisher for, you know, translation into Bulgarian. And it was really interesting. I've done translations through BabelCube for a lot of my books. And I don't make a whole lot of money off of them. For some reason, Portuguese seems to do better than others. And I'm gradually filling in the gaps with translations of missing books. But a part of me wishes that I had held off and just not done anything and waited to see what happened. Because this publisher came to me out of the blue. They sought me out, had a very quick negotiation, and the advance alone is more than I've made on BabelCube in the few years that I've been publishing with them. And I'll also get royalties. And it's really cool because this is a publisher that publishes big-time people, Stephen King, James Rollins, people like that. So my book is going to be in there too, which is really awesome. But like I said, it makes me wonder if perhaps the wise business decision would have been to hold on to those foreign language rights instead of diving into the indie mode. And that can be a disadvantage of that indie spirit and being quick to try new things and leaping onto a lot of new platforms in the indie world. Sometimes you make business decisions that don't really work out. For the most part, jumping into new platforms early has worked for me. But foreign language, maybe not so much. I'm not totally giving up on improving our sales once we have more Dane Maddock books translated. For example, you know, if in Italian we've only got book 5 and nothing else, I don't know how well that's going to do. The other issue is that while there are Amazon stores and other ebook stores in some cases, in other countries, culturally, ebook readers have not particularly caught on. And so you still have the challenge of most readers in a lot of European countries, for example, still read paperbacks and want to buy them in stores, which, you know, I think a lot of us can sympathize with that. We miss bookstores, those of us who no longer have one within a reasonable driving distance to go to. And for a lot of people, the nostalgia and just the experience of going into a bookstore is more fun than the discounting of buying an ebook and the convenience of it, or the ordering of a paperback online. That's an entirely different show. But anyway, that's one of the things we're up against unless we sell translation rights to a traditional publisher in some of these countries. That was something I wasn't really aware of at the time I decided to try BabelCube. At that point, I had queried a couple of foreign rights agents. They weren't interested. And that at that point, I just gave up. So now, you know, it's a celebration because I got the contract and my book is at some point next year going to come out in traditional format with a big publisher. So that's exciting. The downside is I do wonder what some of these other languages might have been worth if I had held on to the rights. But, you know, who knows? You live and learn. But anyway, it's going to be interesting. The publisher chose Xibalba, which is book number 8 of the Dane Maddock series. At the first discussion, they were just interested in something of mine, wanting to publish me. I had recommended Blood Codex, which was the first in the Jake Crowley series. At that point, it was ranking super high. I liked that it was book number one. It had some chapters set in Eastern Europe. I thought it was a good fit, but it's co-authored, and I'm guessing they wanted to start with just something that was my name on it, so they went with Jabalba, which at that time was the highest-ranking Dane Maddock book. So we'll see how it goes. I'm guessing they'll just put it out as a Dane Maddock adventure and not necessarily call it book number 8, because that would be crazy. And they did say that if it sells, then they'll talk about doing more. So that's kind of fun. Also had, to balance it out, some disappointing professional news that right now I can't really talk about. It's something that most authors run into at some point if you are published by someone else. So that right there will narrow it down for you if you're familiar with my catalog. But, you know, still trying to work through that and figure out what's going to happen. But, you know, there are disappointments even when you're doing fairly well in your career. There are things that are going to happen that, you know, just don't work out the way you had hoped. And you have to make your smartest business decisions when those things happen and make the choices that ultimately protect yourself. So I'll should be able to talk about that more a little down the road, but we'll see. So that is what is going on with me in my writing and publishing life. One thing happening in the publishing industry that's getting a lot of attention is some more issues with Amazon tied into scammers and Amazon trying and sometimes failing to punish the people who cheat. We have talked about in past episodes that one scam that a lot of authors will do, especially some of these box set promoters, is hire click farms. They put a book into Kindle Unlimited, pay a click farm to borrow a ton of books, shoots it up the rankings, and they get a bigger share of the Kindle Unlimited pie. And when writers have been caught doing that, one of the things that Amazon sometimes does is strip them of their sales ranking. Now, what that means is the book loses a ton of visibility. It can no longer be seen in any bestseller charts or any genre lists. And if the author was getting any author rank benefit from that, that is no longer going to provide impetus to your author rank. You're no longer getting any sales credit for those books. Well, I mean, that's a nice thing if you punish the right people. But some friends of mine last week had a book bub for a book bundle. Some of the authors involved are New York Times bestsellers. Others are USA Today bestsellers. I think all of them are successful hybrid authors, meaning they've got some trad pub success and some indie success. And anyway, their book, just like any book bub, it shot up the rankings, not as high as they had hoped. It did okay. But for some reason, Amazon stripped them of their rankings and sent them these harsh warnings. Well, the problem is this book wasn't even in Kindle Unlimited, so it wasn't suddenly getting all these weird borrows. And so obviously, one of the big advantages to getting a book bub deal is your book shoots up the rankings for a couple of days, and then you reset to the higher price while you're highly visible on all these bestseller charts, while the Amazon recommendation engines have pushed you to the fronts of the also-bought pages of a lot of other books. That's when you really make hay with the aftermath of a book bub. Well, when their rankings were stripped, all of that went away. And in typical Amazon fashion, they got, you know, a lot of generic customer service speak. They spoke with high-level reps, some of whom I've talked to about concerns, and got the typical reassurances, but nothing got done. And then within a few days, they did get their ranking back after the box set had plummeted. And I'm hearing periodically, not a ton, from other authors who are known to be ethical people for many reasons, who have had verifiable, legitimate promotions going on, such as BookBubs, who have suddenly had this happen to them. And one thing that most of them have in common, not this particular group of authors that I just mentioned, but others who are running into this and getting their ranking stripped, they have been very public, either on social media, on their websites, in forums, or in all of those places, at calling out these cheaters, especially the box set cheaters. And a few episodes back, we talked about one particular box set scammer who's been a big problem, who now has a lawsuit filed against her, but she has her adherents and her minions, and one of the thing she's being sued over, if I understand correctly, is that whenever somebody is uncomfortable with her shady business practices and tries to back out, she gets all her minions to one-star their books and attack the person on social media. And so we know that there are vindictive people out there who will aggressively defend their tactics. And there is a theory floating about that some of the people who are vocally speaking out, boy, that's redundant, isn't it? Who are speaking out against these click farms are having click farms pointed at their own books as a way of punishment so that they're going to get in trouble with Amazon and also look like a hypocrite. If I had books in Kindle Unlimited, which I don't, and I'm criticizing people for using click farms, then boom, I get my ranking stripped because I had a click farmed book. Yeah, that undercuts my credibility. If you want to read more about this whole issue, David Cochran is really following it. He's trying very hard to talk with Amazon to get answers. Check out his website. It's David Cochran, G-A-U-G-H-R-A-N. And I know a lot of other authors with a lot more clout than I have are also talking to Amazon, trying to get some answers, trying to get them to be smarter about what they're doing. It's possible that they're trying to put automated systems in place to catch some of these scammers and that it's just not working very well yet. It still needs refinement. But again, the common denominator with a lot of these authors is that they are opposing these click farmers and these scammers. And so, you know, there's a concern that maybe the online lynch mobs are getting after them. We hope not. But anyway, as always, use your best business practices. Be prepared to document yourself if you have big promotions, you know, to be able to show, hey, I paid for a BookBub on this date. Here's where it appeared. Here's my receipt. And, you know, just try to be ethical and honest and reach out to the community if you run into a problem, because there are people who will support you. So that's what's happening in the publishing industry. And then another thing that's on my mind that's sort of happening is the whole issue of sensitivity. And it's something I've been thinking about talking about for a few weeks because of some different things. And then just in the last day or so, I read about an amusing little anecdote with Saladin Ahmed, who is a fantasy author. He wrote one book, and I think he's now writing for Marvel or something. But he did have one book that had a lot of good reviews and got some notoriety because he is an author of Middle Eastern descent, and I believe that he is a Muslim. And so he, one of the things he does using his platform is to speak out about issues that affect people like him and other people who are part of marginalized groups. And this one is, on the surface, it's just kind of funny. His kids were looking at a box of Corn Pops and just staring at it and noticed, you know, the artwork on the box has loads and loads of Corn Pops, which are just little round yellow cereals, doing all kinds of crazy things. I think they were swimming and playing around. And then in the midst of them, there is one Corn Pop that's wearing clothes. This Corn Pop has brown skin and is a janitor. He's clearly cleaning the floor. And it just suddenly seemed very bizarre to him. He's like, wait a minute. There's only one brown Corn Pop. You put him in blue clothes so he stands out against all the plain yellow Corn Pops, and you made him a janitor. You made your only brown Corn Pop a janitor. And he said, yes, you know, it's a small thing, but if my kids are noticing it, there are other kids who are noticing it. So he sent out a tweet, and again saying, it isn't a huge thing, but made his point. And to their credit, I think Kellogg's is the company that makes Corn Pops. They replied within a few hours, said they're updating the artwork, and they're going to fix it. And so it was kind of neat to see an author make a change. And predictably, there were, you know, an array of responses, which is the reality in the internet world. There were people who thought it was great. There were people who thought it was funny. There are people who kind of understood that he wasn't making a huge deal out of it, but that it was nice that he brought it up. It should have been considered. There were people who pulled out the old, well, don't you have anything better to worry about? There are people who swore they would never eat Kellogg's food again because they caved into political correctness. There are people who accused him of searching out things to be offended by. To me, what it is, the crux of the issue is somebody designed that artwork. Somebody made the choice to only have one brown Corn Pop, put it in clothing, bright blue clothing so it stood out, and making it a janitor. Somebody made that choice. Why? and then somebody did not quality check it. So it was just weird, and I think it's great that they fixed it and that it didn't set off a huge firestorm and lots of boycotts, because we live in a world now where people are very reactionary. There are an insane number of people on social media, and it only takes a few offended people to stir things up and to create problems. And that sort of ties into our topic today of sensitivity. I want to start by talking about an issue that is becoming more popular. It's not even an issue. It's a new job in publishing, and that is sensitivity reading. Now, when I first heard about sensitivity readers, I thought it was a little strange. I inferred that it was basically a political correctness police officer who was going to read your manuscript and tell you what you couldn't put in there because it might offend somebody. But that's not really true. Quick overview, what a sensitivity reader does. This is a person who works on your manuscript, supplements the work of your story editor, your proofer. Some of the things this reader does is provides a manuscript evaluation and feedback regarding characters who are from underrepresented or marginalized groups. Maybe you have a Native American character. Maybe you have a character with a disability. Something other than what you're writing, and specifically a marginalized group about which society might have a lot of misconceptions or a lack of information. This reader will identify inaccuracies in respect to the person or group that you're talking about. I have a link up to episode 48 of the Ditch Diggers podcast. I want to recommend that everybody listen to this. If you're an author, they do a very thorough interview with a person who does sensitivity reading, and she goes into great detail. I learned a lot from it. So the link is on the Wood on Words site, but it's Ditch Diggers episode 48. It's a great podcast. You should be listening to the podcast anyway if you want to be a professional writer. But anyway, one of the things that their guest explained, or one of the illustrations she gave, was as a visually impaired person, she had her cane that she uses and is an extension of her body. And she has very specific feelings about her cane. She would feel a very specific way if she were to lose it. There are certain things she does or does not do with it, depending on where she is and what she's doing. That's the kind of thing that she might catch if you, say, had a visually impaired person who used a cane in your manuscript. She pointed out that there's a lot of technology available to visually impaired people that's very common, but if you're not visually impaired, you might not know anything about this, and so you might unintentionally use an outdated mode of technology, or you might write about a challenge that a person has that really doesn't exist to the average person with that disability. Or there might be challenges this person faces doing the things that you have them doing that you aren't even aware of, never thought of, because you haven't walked in their shoes. So I think the inaccuracy or the things you haven't thought of is a very important service that this kind of reader can provide. The sensitivity reader can also provide feedback specifically on the character. She gave the example of if she were offered the ability to have her sight fully restored, she probably wouldn't do it. She said she definitely wouldn't do it. Because for her, it would be such an adjustment in every single facet of her life. She would have so much to relearn at her age that it would be too traumatic for her. She's comfortable in the life that she said. So that's just one little example. But basically, your worldview is shaped by your experiences and your culture of origin, your community, and your body, and what your limitations and abilities are. So that's another thing a sensitivity reader can give you. Calling attention to bias or negatively charged language, that's a kind of obvious one. But, you know, with the issue of bias, there are things that we might not even be aware are biases. Growing up in the Bible Belt, I knew a lot of people who really had never known, had close relationships with anyone who wasn't from their race and roughly their same socioeconomic group. And there were things they quote-unquote knew about, say, black people, for example, as if black people are all alike, and that just aren't true. And I was fortunate enough that I lived, before I moved to Santa Fe, for a number of years in a diverse community. I taught in a very diverse school, got to know a lot of awesome people. And, you know, I'd like to think that because of my upbringing and the schools I attended and places I lived, that I had a little bit better handle than most. But still, the more closely you interact with people who are different than you, the more your eyes are opened. And so there are things, if we were writing a character who's very different than us, that we might just take for granted that are true, and it would never occur to us that they're false. So that's another thing that a sensitivity reader can do for you. So it's not, I don't really like the word sensitivity, but I can't think of a better title for this type of reader, but it's basically a get your shit correct reader. And the point is that this type of reader can make your manuscript better. Another thing I wasn't aware of is different sensitivity readers have different specialties. Some might have a couple, depending on what their personal story is, but the same sensitivity reader that helps you with your character who is an African-American from, I don't know, Detroit, who grew up in maybe a very underprivileged community, is not going to be the same sensitivity reader who helps you with your Inuit character or your deaf character. So, different sensitivity readers have different specialties, and they're not there to be the police over your manuscript. If you're traditionally published, obviously, when that sensitivity reader provides feedback, your editor might insist that you follow some of it. But it's going to be a negotiation just like any other with manuscript feedback and editorial feedback. But they're just there to help you make it better, to make your characters more accurate, to make your writing more believable. It's not just about trying not to hurt somebody's feelings with a careless word. So I thought that was very interesting to learn about this. So again, I recommend Ditch Diggers podcast overall and episode 48 in specific. But one of the reasons that this interesting topic really started to resonate with me was there was a bit of a kerfuffle regarding a forthcoming book. And I'm calling it a kerfuffle because I don't think it merits a controversy, and I'll explain why. There's a young adult book coming out at the end of January called American Heart by Laura Moriarty. And this is an author who wrote a dystopian novel about a future where Muslims are put into detention centers. And her protagonist was a white character, but she has a very important Muslim immigrant character as one of her main characters as well. And she's dealing with sensitive issues regarding a marginalized and very small religious group in America. And, you know, on that note, it's interesting. I was engaged in a Facebook discussion the other day, and somebody was showing a graphic of all the counties in America and by color which religion had the majority in that county. And there were no counties in America that had a Jewish majority or a Muslim majority, for example. And a lot of people were questioning it, but when he shared statistics, non-Christian religions only make up, depending on which source you look at, somewhere between 6 and 7.5% of the entire religious population, or the entire population of the United States. Or maybe it was 4. I'm doing this off the top of my head. I hadn't planned on segueing into this. And somebody said, no, New York, there's got to be some majority Jewish counties. But even in the counties or the states that have the highest Jewish populations, they still only represent 6%. So some people might hear this whole thing about Muslims being underrepresented in a tiny group. But they are very small, which is weird when we hear so much of the political and social discourse saying that Muslims are overrunning the country or that Jews own all of this industry or whatever. It's actually a very tiny fraction of our population. So obviously, this author was dealing with, you know, some situations where she wanted to do a good job. She wanted to be sensitive to the issues and was keenly aware that she was dealing with a very underrepresented population in America. And so she did the right things. She studied, she researched, she had friends who, her important Muslim character was from Iran. So she had Iranian friends read it and give feedback. And she used multiple sensitivity readers. And she tried very hard to avoid what we call the white savior trope, which is basically the minority people, for lack of a better term, are brought to see the light or lifted up out of the darkness or whatever by the white savior. Sort of like the La La Land movie, where I haven't seen it, but I am told that one of the problems to some people with that movie is that an African-American musician loses his passion and it's up to the white savior guy to stoke the fires back in him. And so he comes, swoops in and brings this guy back to the light. And she tried very hard not to do that with her book. And so it had a Publisher's Weekly review, excuse me, a Kirkus review, and it was given a starred review, which is awesome. So Kirkus agreed that she had done a good job handling the topic, the subject matter, did it with sensitivity, did it with professionalism, loved the book. And when you get a starred review, that's going to make a big difference in your bookstore sales. It's more of a traditional publisher issue than an indie author issue. But anyway, got a great review. And then out came the internet lynch mob. And I'm not going to bother naming the people, but there's a certain person who's a big figure in this movement. But quickly, months before the book came out, before anyone had read it, other than the reviewers, people started one-starring her on Goodreads, calling the book White Savior trash, and stirring up a big controversy. People who had not read the book, they saw the subject matter and the general plot and made assumptions about it and reacted strongly to it, really trashed the book. And Kirkus, it's very frustrating, they took the step of editing their review in response to all this criticism and taking away the star. And so it's very clear that when you do that, it's no longer an objective review. It's placating people who are upset. And that's a very frustrating experience, obviously, for the author and the publisher. But also, in general, just knowing that people who haven't read a book are going to sometimes make assumptions about it and create problems, especially when you're dealing with issues of sensitivity. And before we attack the modern snowflake generation, I can say that I remember this from even my young and teen years. Heavy metal band would come to town, and people who had never listened to one of their songs would picket outside the concert hall. The movie The Passion of the Christ came out. People who had never seen the movie were, again, trying to boycott the movie theater to try to put them out of business just for running the movie at all. So, and those were generations even older than my parents. So we're younger people are not the only ones who get offended by things and react strongly to it. We just now have the internet, so it's magnified. But anyway, when I look at something like American Heart and what happened to this book, it can be very discouraging. And there is a temptation to say, you know what, the hell with it. I'm just going to write whatever I want to write and not even going to try to be sensitive because I can't win. I don't think that's the way to go. And I want to be clear, I do write diverse characters in my books. My protagonists are almost always white. A couple of them are not. And I don't claim to be awesome at this. I base them heavily on close friends of mine. I get feedback from close friends of mine who, you know, hail from these different backgrounds. I do a lot of research, and I try to do well. I don't make their ethnicities a huge issue. And, you know, it could be that a critic would read my stuff and, you know, think I really suck at it, but I do try. I would prefer giving it my best shot and maybe not being the best at it to just completely whitewashing my books, which, frankly, in men's adventure and action adventure, you can get by with. You can have a few white dudes and some hot chicks, and that's all you're, and then bad guys. And, you know, for the average reader, not all, there are readers who want more. But for the average reader, that's all they really want. And if you look back at the the origins of the men's adventure, you know, it started out with a lot of the old pulps, the adventure stories, but it sort of morphed into the 70s, especially into some really misogynistic stuff. And so the roots are there that would allow somebody to not be too sensitive. But I want to do a better job than that. But anyway, even though this situation with American Heart is not atypical, there are internet lynch mobs out there who will overreact to things or react without actually knowing all the facts, I don't think it's an excuse to not try. So, first thing we need to remember is that given enough reach, if enough people read or at least hear about our books, some people are going to hate or be offended by what we do. I don't know how many Christians I've offended with the Dane Maddock books. I don't mean to. I was a pastor when I wrote some of them. But the reality is that if you're going to use biblical characters and biblical artifacts and then change those stories, which is what I do, I think it would be very boring if the Ark were always on Mount Ararat and, you know, things like that. If I only stuck with the traditional, so I'll put major twists on these Bible stories. Some people are going to really, really hate that. I think I might have mentioned on a previous episode that with my book Cibola, I can tell where someone quit reading depending on whether their negative review says that I'm advancing the Mormon agenda, that I'm being anti-Mormon, or that I'm being anti-Christian. I've even been accused of writing books for the sole sake of attacking the Bible. So, you know, I've gotten that. Now, my book, The Zombie-Driven Life, is a satire of the purpose-driven life that, you know, is intentionally meant to inflame while also trying to get people to think, but that hasn't gotten nearly as much feedback because it doesn't sell very well. But if enough people see your work, you're going to piss some people off. You absolutely cannot avoid it. So all we can really do is try to do our best. When I talk about this, I'm reminded of a scene from The Big Bang Theory where something happens and Sheldon, who's the brilliant genius guy, says, "People unfamiliar with the law of large numbers would call this a coincidence." And basically, in a nutshell, and I'm probably going to get it wrong because I'm not Sheldon, the law of large numbers basically says, given enough incidents, enough experiments, enough whatever, you will get a certain percentage of expected results, of any one specific expected result. And, you know, we're living in a world where they, as of early 2017, there were 330 million people on Twitter. And roughly, according to this, 500 million tweets going out per day. 500 million. And what we see is that our media in particular will take three or four tweets that have something in common and write an article, an editorial, a column, whatever, painting a group of people with a certain brush. There's one, I have friends and family members who like this one particular conservative blogger, and he'll pick three tweets and say, "This is how liberals think." I've seen the same thing from the liberal side where they'll pick, you know, three really, really stupid tweets and make fun of the conservative morons who believe this. But the reality is, with 500 million tweets going out every day, you're going to find something represented for everybody. And so realistically, if 10 people get pissed off about a certain book and send out multiple tweets about it, some people will retweet it because they agree. Some people retweet it because they'll think, oh, that's an issue that I'm sympathetic about. I'll share this without actually learning about it. It can very quickly seem like a whole lot of people. And if you've got a book on Amazon without many reviews and 10 people band together and leave you one star, yeah, that sucks. That's going to make your book look pretty bad. I believe you can write it out no matter what. But like I said, we live in a world where we'll never be able to avoid offending everybody. So the best we can do is be as professional as we can. So let's talk about what can we do to try to be sensitive with the understanding that we're never going to please everybody. Some people always object to what we do. First thing I would recommend is reading a book called Writing the Other by Nissi Shaul and Cynthia Ward. It's not a very long book. It's not very expensive. You can get it on Amazon. I've got a link up on the website. And it has exercises to help you work through this. But that's a great source of information just to get you to start thinking about some things and trying to do a better job. And, you know, I think it's part of improving your craft. Why not try to be aware of, quote unquote, the other and try to do a better job of writing it? Avoid cliches and stereotypes. I'm not going to be Michael Scott from The Office and illustrate that point with some of them, but you know what they are. There are stereotypes associated with every group. And be careful with how you use them. And I am probably guilty of, because one of my characters, Bones, the sidekick to Dane Maddock, is Native American. He grew up in North Carolina. And part of his character is that he hates rednecks. And I think as a brown person growing up in the South, I think that's understandable. So I will on occasion have him encounter some stereotypical rednecks. And I use some of the stereotypes like the John Deere hat and the blaring country music and the pickup truck. I'm doing it intentionally. they're usually bad guys. And I think it's I hope it's exaggerated enough to the point that people understand what I'm doing, but, you know, that's an example of a stereotype. But again, these are white people, and in America, they are the majority. They're not the oppressed group, so there is a difference. And we don't have time to go into why, but there is a difference between stereotyping the majority privileged culture and the marginalized culture. So avoid stereotypes. Another thing, don't simply write white people in masks, or don't simply write a man with boobs. This is something that I worry about a lot. Like I said, I try to really put myself to model my characters after close friends who I know well. I try to get feedback from beta readers to make sure I'm not doing too bad a job on this. But, you know, I've got a series with an Asian American protagonist, a series that has an ensemble cast, but the leader is an African-American female. And, you know, Maddox's circle is very diverse as well. So it would be very easy just to write a bunch of white people who act the same, who talk the same, who like the same things, who see the world in the same way. And that's one of your keys, is stopping to think about how would this person see the world differently than my Caucasian protagonist, for example, like I did with Bones, and how I could give you other examples, but basically know their backstory, know what they went through, and try to extrapolate again how they would see the world and how they would react to different situations, and you know, look for firsthand accounts that you can base that on. But don't just give a person a different skin color, but just make them another regular old generic character. Do your research, and like we talked about before, don't just assume that there's some common wisdom that you've always known to be true, that everybody around you has said to be true. Don't assume that it is true, because maybe it's not. Avoid the white savior trope that we talked about. Now, obviously in the Dane Maddox series, Dane Maddox is the hero. But that doesn't mean that he is just because he's saving the day doesn't mean he's bringing wisdom and enlightenment to marginalized cultures. It doesn't mean that they couldn't save themselves without him. And we keep talking about marginalized cultures. Obviously, gender is at play here. Female characters have the same issue. I like to make sure that all the characters have purposes, that they contribute. Sometimes they save Maddox bacon. They share information that he didn't know. They help him see things that he might not have gotten. Everybody has a role to play. So yeah, he's the hero. He's the main protagonist. But he's not the savior of everybody. Don't appropriate the stories of marginalized cultures. And this is kind of a tricky one. You can refer to, like folklore of the Aboriginal people. They're very defensive about that. Native American stories, things like that. You can allude to them. You can make use of them in stories. You can be aware of them and have characters who are aware of them, but don't steal the people's stories and retell them and make money off of it. That's unkind. And importantly, get feedback on your work. It can be from beta readers. Maybe you need a diverse cast of beta readers. Maybe you need certain beta readers who slot right into this other, quote-unquote, that you're writing, these different types of characters. But, you know, or maybe you hire sensitivity readers, but have somebody else take a look at your work. And finally, you know, just do your best. Give it a sincere effort. Maybe some people won't like what you do. Maybe you'll get some negative reviews. Maybe you'll get some unfair accusations. But there's no way you can avoid it. If you whitewash your books, you're going to get criticized for that. If you include diverse characters and do a poor job, some people will criticize you for that too. There's no winning there other than to do your best, to try to keep getting better, and so that at the end of the day, if people have a problem with what you did, you can honestly say, look, I've done everything I can, and I'll continue to do so, and thank you for helping me improve and learn. I appreciate your feedback. So, those are my thoughts on sensitivity. I hope that you got a little something out of it. Next week, we're going to be back with another topical show. I'm going to have to double-check my calendar. I think that's what's on the calendar, but then coming up in November, we've got another series of indie author rockstar interviews. I've got some great people lined up. You're really going to enjoy them. So anyway, as always, thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.